Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the June 8th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that usually comes your way the second and fourth Wednesday of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. That's a regular schedule, but on May 25th, the last fourth Wednesday, I was in Washington, D.C., about to fly back after speaking at a panel at the Code Pink-sponsored Move Over APAC conference and participating in activities around the annual policy conference of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or APAC. That event was attended by more than 10,000 members and guests, including 1,500 college students, 215 of whom were student body presidents, and in another demonstration of its unparalleled political muscle, three-quarters of both the House and Senate. What was even more obscene, and that's the most charitable word I used to describe the ugly affair, was the manner in which a joint session of both houses of Congress greeted Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in his speech on May 24th. Here was the head of a foreign country, after having publicly challenged and once again humiliated the President of the United States on a key foreign policy issue, receiving at least 29 standing ovations, apart from the ringing standing applause that greeted his entrance onto the floor of Congress in his triumphal departure. The confrontation between President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu and the significance was the subject of a conversation that I had with Dr. Hatem Bazian from the University of California on the morning after I returned, which was recorded by Collision Course Video, and you will hear the better part of that discussion later on today's program. I'll have some more comments on the APAC conference, but first I want to point out that today, June 8th, marks the 44th anniversary of what may have been the defining event in the history of U.S.-Israel relations. It was on that afternoon in 1967, on the fourth day of what came to be known as the Six-Day War, that a lightly armed U.S. intelligence gathering ship, the USS Liberty, was attacked by the confined forces of the Israeli Air Force and Navy, leaving 34 U.S. sailors dead and 171 wounded. Few Americans know about it, and be assured there will be no speeches on the floor of Congress today memorializing that attack. And if by chance there happened to be, you would not read about it in the mainstream media or hear about it on NPR, Fox News, CNN, or MSNBC. The way the U.S. Navy sailors and their ship were treated by Washington that day was of a piece with the reception given by Prime Minister Netanyahu 2 weeks ago. When a Mayday call was sent out from the Liberty that it was under attack, before the Israelis managed to shatter its radio transmitter, Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara immediately responded by sending fighters from U.S. Navy aircraft carrier to the ship's defense. But when he learned that the attackers were Israeli, he called them back. The survivors were ordered not to talk about what happened on the threat of court-martial, and while the ship's captain was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor, it was not given by President Lyndon Johnson of the White House, but by a subordinate with a minimum publicity at the Washington Navy Yard. Over the years, there have been a number of government investigations, all of which were designed to cover up the attack and make it appear as if it was a mistake, while demands from the survivors that Congress hold its own investigation have gone unmet. Israel's excuse, which was accepted by Washington, was that the Liberty had been mistaken for a smaller Egyptian boat that was not even seaworthy and looked nothing like the Liberty. Besides, to the survivors, the Liberty was flying a 13-by-9-foot American flag, which was clearly visible on a Sunday afternoon. Why Israel took the risk of attacking an American naval vessel has long been speculated by those who aren't buying the notion that it was a mistake. But since the ship was monitoring Israeli radio traffic, it is considered likely that the Israelis were going to say things they didn't want Washington or anyone else to hear. What Lyndon Johnson made clear was that he didn't want to embarrass a friend, Israel, and that he was reportedly having an affair with a beautiful ex-Mossad agent, Matilda Krim, whose husband, Arthur, was a major contributor to the Democratic Party and to his political campaign may also have had something to do with it. That pro-Israel donors are major contributors to both political parties, and particularly to the Democrats, was no doubt one of the reasons that even the highest-ranking Democrats in Congress, Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid and House Whip Steny Hoyer, were not only willing but apparently eager to betray their president when they took their turns addressing a cheering APAC crowd, making statements that Obama's opponents are already putting to good use. including 31-second spot put out on YouTube by the Emergency Committee for Israel. This committee came into being during the 2010 campaign and was founded and still headed by leading neocon artist William Crystal, editor and columnist for the Weekly Standard and a regular talking head on mainstream television. It was not a good week for President Obama, to put it mildly. Flying higher in the polls after having had his Navy SEALs take out Osama bin Laden, he was reminded who really runs Washington, and it's not him. At a joint press conference with Netanyahu the day after his speech to the State Department on U.S. policy for the Middle East, the president had to sit through a dressing down by the Israeli prime minister that was unprecedented in American history, as was the reception accorded to Netanyahu by Congress. In his talk to the State Department, Obama had simply reiterated what has been standard U.S. policy since the Clinton administration, that there should be a Palestinian state based on the borders established during the 1967 war with, quote, mutually agreed upon land swipes, end quote. Netanyahu and his supporters in Israel and the United States, which includes virtually the entire Congress, pretended not to hear the reference to land swaps and began to loudly berate the president while Israel's trusted stable of columnists in the U.S. media followed suit, thus obliging Obama to come before the members of AIPAC, lobbyists for a foreign government, two weeks ago Sunday, to defend himself and explain that his words had been misunderstood. It was truly a sad and sorry spectacle, and if one had hopes that our president had any spine, those hopes by now have completely evaporated. Here's how some others saw the lopsided affair. First, Glenn Greenwald of Salon.com, who frequently appears on Democracy Now!, he wrote, quote, "What makes them more remarkable, this more remarkable still, is that this foreign leader, whom they were cheering so boisterously and continuously, just completed a public, ugly conflict with the American leader and has a long record of demonstrated indifference to American interests. Yet the super patriots of the American right sided so brazenly and publicly with this foreign policy leader over their own country's president." Meanwhile, both political parties in Congress are in frantic competition to see which one can lavish Netanyahu with more obsequious praise. That's Glenn Greenwald. Now here's Uri Avneri, an 87-year-old former Israeli Knesset member and longtime peace activist. He says, quote, "It was all rather disgusting," and as he wrote in his weekly essay distributed on the internet. There they were, the members of the highest legislative bodies of the world's only superpower, flying up and down like so many yo-yos, applauding wildly every few minutes or seconds the most outrageous lies and distortions of Benjamin Netanyahu. What the American senators and congressmen fear was a fate worse than death. Anyone remaining seated or not applauding wildly enough could have been caught on camera, and that amounts to political suicide. It was enough for one single congressman to rise and applaud, and all the others had to follow suit. Who would dare not to? End quote. Uri Avneri. Now, this from Walter Reed of the Council of Foreign Relations, an uncritical supporter of Israel, literally gloating over the debacle, writing ironically in a magazine called American Interest. Obama's record of grotesque, humiliating, and total diplomatic failure in his dealings with Prime Minister Netanyahu has few parallels in American history, writes Mead. Three times he's gone up against Netanyahu, three times he's ingloriously failed. This last defeat, Netanyahu's deadly, devastating speech to Congress, in which he eviscerated President Obama's foreign policy to prolonged and repeated standing ovations by members of both parties, may have been the single most stunning and effective public rebuke to an American president a foreign leader has ever delivered. "Netanyahu beat Obama like a red-headed stepchild," wrote Mead. "He played him like a fiddle. He pouted like a big brass drum." It's like this is a big bad brass drum. "The Prime Minister of Israel danced rings around his arrogant professorial opponent. It was like watching the Harlem Globetrotters go up against the junior squad from Miss Porter's school, like watching Harvard play Texas A&M, like watching Bambi meet Godzilla, or Bill Clinton run against Bob Dole. The Prime Minister mopped the floor with our guy," continues Mead. "Obama made a 67 speech. Bibi ripped him into shreds. Obama goes to AIPAC, nervous, off balance, backing and filling. Then Bibi drops a C-bomb, C for Congress, demonstrating to the whole world that the Prime Minister of Israel has substantially more support in both the House and the Senate than the President of the United States," end quote. That was Walter Russell Mead of the Council on Foreign Relations, who clearly enjoyed watching his president take a verbal beating, and yet it was Obama and not Netanyahu who Mead had the nerve to call arrogant. New York Congressman Anthony Weiner took time off from exposing his drawers to young ladies on Twitter to meet with Netanyahu right after his speech, and he also deserted his president, noting on his website that, quote, "Israel remains our nation's strongest ally in the Middle East, and I made it clear to the Prime Minister we will continue to offer our steadfast support to the one true democracy in that region of the world." Time after time, said Democrat Weiner's statement, Israel has made its intention for peace clear, and setting unnecessary preconditions for negotiations will not lead us toward peace in the region. We've been down this road before, end quote. Well, I'm not sure what he means when he uses the term we, but I suspect that Weiner is now Schnitzel and his days in Congress numbered. Let's finish this segment with a comment from the distinguished British journalist Robert Fisk, writing in The Independent of London, end quote. There was an interesting linguistic collapse in the president's language over these critical days. 4 days, wrote Fisk. On Thursday, May 19th, he referred to the continuation of Israeli settlements. A day later, Netanyahu was lecturing him on, quote-unquote, certain demographic changes that have taken place on the ground, end quote. Then when Obama addressed AIPAC on Sunday, he had cravenly adopted Netanyahu's own preposterous expression. Now he, too, wrote Fisk, spoke of new demographic realities on the ground. Who would believe that he was talking about internationally illegal Jewish colonies built on lands stolen from Arabs in one of the biggest property heists in the history of Palestine? That's from Robert Fisk. Following the AIPAC conference, President Obama went even further in conceding his defeat by putting up a special page on the White House website pledging America's continued support for Israel's security and maintaining the Israel-U.S. special relationship. There was no mention of the Palestinians. What both Israel and Washington are concerned about at the moment is the prospect that the PLO, with the Palestinian Authority and Hamas at least temporarily united, will go to the meeting of the UN General Assembly in September and request it to recognize the state of Palestine within the 1967 borders. While the General Assembly vote is almost certainly to pass by a wide margin, it is not sufficient to bring a Palestinian state, even legally, into being. That is a privilege accorded only to the Security Council, where the U.S. is sure to veto it. Nevertheless, Israel and its agents in the U.S., and that includes Congress, are worried about the ramifications of the General Assembly vote recognizing the existence of a Palestinian state and doing everything they can to forestall, if not defeat it. And that was clearly at the top of the agenda of our chastened President Obama when he met with representatives of the G8 in the week following the AIPAC conference. On its part, leading members of Congress have threatened to call for cutoff of U.S. payments to the United Nations should the General Assembly act favorably on the Palestinian request. And such a move was advocated by former U.S. Ambassador to the UN and overt agent for Israel, John Bolton, in an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. If the shameful abdication of their responsibilities as representatives of the American people before Netanyahu by our members of Congress were not enough, can anyone seriously argue that Washington is not Israel's most important occupied territory? There was something else going on in Washington at the time of the AIPAC convention, although it was quite smaller and got more press in Israel than it did here. That was the first Move Over AIPAC conference, organized by Code Pink, which attracted more than 300 participants and began with an all-day gathering of plenaries and workshops on Saturday, May 21st, and then moved into the streets and across from the convention center during the AIPAC convention. Its activities included a march around and in front of the Department of Justice, where a frequent guest of mine, Grant Smith, of the Institute for Research in Middle East Policy, and a fellow Move Over AIPAC workshop panelist, led a colorful protest demanding that AIPAC be obliged to register as a foreign agent, something that had been demanded by President Kennedy and Brother Bobby as Attorney General before JFK was assassinated. Last year, Smith filed a 369-page brief with the Department of Justice requesting that the department get off the dime and follow up what the Kennedys had started. From the Justice Department, the protesters proceeded to the convention center, stopping on the way at the headquarters of National Public Radio, loudly demanding, "Cover this." A number of marchers entered the NPR lobby, but agreed to leave after being promised that a reporter would come down and talk with them, but no reporter came. Meanwhile, in Tel Aviv this past Saturday, an estimated 25,000 Israelis, made up of all the peace groups and leftist center parties who put aside their differences, marched in support of a Palestinian state based on the 67 borders, the very thing that our members of Congress find abhorrent. It's not a story that the mainstream American media, another occupied territory, chose to report. And on the 44th anniversary of the Six-Day War, Palestinian refugees in Syria attempted a peaceful march to Israel's border with the illegally annexed Golan Heights, where they were greeted with live fire from Israeli troops when tear gas failed to stop them. 23 people, mostly young, were reportedly killed, another 350 wounded. At his weekly cabinet meeting, now back in Israel, Prime Minister Netanyahu said he would not allow, quote, extremist elements, unquote, to penetrate Israel's borders. Quote, I have instructed the security forces to act with determination, with maximum restraint, but with determination to maintain our sovereignty, our borders, our communities, and our citizens, end quote.